This is Metro Connection. I'm David First. For many people, a driving factor behind the decision to go green is health. Our personal health, the health of animals, plants, and yes, the health of the planet. And not a day goes by without hearing about some new environmentally friendly product or an award-winning green building. But in places where health is practiced, the green changeover has been slow. Matt Bush has more.
For an industry that follows the Hippocratic Oath, first do no harm, the healthcare field actually does harm the environment quite a bit.
The healthcare sector is about 16% of the gross domestic product in the United States and probably 10 or 12% in Canada and in other parts of the world. Just being that large a contributor to the gross domestic product, I think, is a signal of how much we use and how much waste we have.
Anna Gilmore Hall is the executive director of Healthcare Without Harm, a group based in Arlington that works globally with hospitals to go green through a variety of ways.
You can't treat healthy patients in an environment that has toxic materials in it. So we really are trying to do as much as we can to assist hospitals in identifying toxic products or safer alternatives to products that they can use to not only green the environment where the patient is, but also realize that they're doing things that actually make it healthier for the patient.
Toxic materials and waste go hand in hand in hospitals, she says, since many one-time use products must be used and are made of plastics, which are detrimental to the environment.
The water pitchers in a hospital that go on the patient's bedside that normally are used by that patient and then either thrown away or taken home by the patient, who then throws it away. You can substitute those things and use glass.
Their efforts are now extending into private doctors' offices, where the challenges of going green are far different. Dr. Linda Holman is an orthodontist with an office in Chevy Chase, Maryland. 3 years ago, she started the green transformation of her office.
The first thing that we did, which was probably the biggest project of all, was to establish electronic medical records. And we went to a completely paperless system.
And paperless means paperless. No charts when she or her assistants work on a patient. Each chair has a computer that can access all the patient's information. And anyone who's sat in a dentist or orthodontist chair knows that flexible overhead light that's shoved in their face so the doctor can get a better look at what's inside their mouth.
No, we don't have those. And you don't bump your head when you get up from the chair on them either.
Patient chairs face large windows, and the light they let into the 15th floor office is enough, according to Dr. Holman.
There are some overhead lights, which are all low-energy using lights that we do use, but that together with the ambient light provides all the lighting that we need. We haven't had any need for additional dental lighting, which tends to be pretty high-intensity light.
Changing the office was one thing. Dr. Holman says they then went about changing behaviors. Their patients?
A lot of people are in the habit of letting the water run while they brush their teeth, which is an incredible waste of water. So we're very careful with patient behavior to not let the water run and to be conservative.
And their own.
We now use china. We use mugs for our coffee. We don't use paper cups. We have no paper products. We don't use plastic silverware in the office. We have real flatware that we use. And it's actually been a very nice change for us. We generally bring our lunches in. We don't have food delivered to us.
That ban on food delivery is rooted in the packaging, and it's the packaging of various supplies shipped to doctors' offices and hospitals that is one of the highest contributors of waste and pollution, according to Healthcare Without Harm. Dr. Holman agrees, giving an example of the packaging she sees for things as small as braces for teeth.
They may ship 20 of the braces in a little plastic bag, like a little tiny Ziploc bag, but that Ziploc bag will come in a box that is big enough to probably package your computer in.
She blames the excess packaging on the need for speed.
I think that our society has become so dependent on the overnight shipping and having things delivered when we want that the companies are concerned that if they don't ship, if one part's available and they don't ship it today, that the customer will be upset with it.
In addition to the healing mission, healthcare is a business. But Dr. Holman says the cost of going green was never a major issue for her.
Most things, I think, are a break even. It certainly hasn't cost us any more money to do this, and there may even be savings down the road. I think especially with electronic charting, there are huge savings.
As for her patients, Dr. Holman says she's received zero complaints. I'm Matt Bush.
We continue with more on the greening of healthcare. Reporter Matt Bush spent time in an orthodontist's office in Chevy Chase, but the job gets a lot bigger when you're dealing with a hospital or a health system. We're joined by Seema Wadhwa, a consultant working as a sustainability engineer with the Inova Health System in Northern Virginia, speaking to us from her office in Fairfax. Welcome.
Thank you.
We heard about making that shift from paper medical charts to electronic records and looking for creative ways to reduce waste. What has Inova done over the past few years to reduce waste?
Inova realized a few years ago that being a responsible member of our community included incorporating really all aspects of sustainability. Inova has a few targeted goals related to energy, water, and waste reductions. But one of the early realizations was that to achieve any of these operational goals, it really meant incorporating a built-in green culture within Inova. So the approach we've taken is to focus on those three operational goals, as well as including environmentally preferable purchasing, alternative transportation, green construction, and sustainable foods as part of the larger program. And some of the interesting opportunities we've had include having farmers markets on site and really tying everything in as a systematic approach. We are indeed working towards electronic records.
How does the carbon footprint of an electronic medical record system compare to, having paper charts?
Well, that's a very good point. Really looking at the programs, it means looking at the entire life cycle impact, because sometimes when looking at a new technology or a new approach such as electronic records may on the surface seem as though it is the right way to go in terms of carbon footprint and being more sustainable, but it is very important to look at the life cycle impact, so it really is a lot of research involved with any decision.
Can you give us some concrete examples of waste in the Inova system and what you've done to make a difference?
Absolutely. One of the largest opportunities for an environmental impact benefit as well as a financial impact is regulated medical waste reduction. The step we took next to actually make the reduction was to work with staff on education as well as to do an audit, a physical audit of the waste streams. That included understanding exactly where the bins are placed, what size they are, how clearly identifiable they are, and then working with the staff to educate them of what truly is defined as regulated medical waste.
Well, a lot of people will tell you toxic waste and healthcare go hand in hand. I mean, there are so many dangerous chemicals used in medicine. Do you try to reduce the amount of chemical used? Do you try to look for other ways of doing things, different ways of treating patients?
Absolutely. One of the key parts of a sustainability plan includes environmentally preferable purchasing. And that really is a front door to ensuring you have a green facility. So in our procurement process, we try to choose products that are environmentally preferable. In a healthcare setting, that is, however, not always possible. But in addition to trying to make choices as to what we're purchasing, we're also very careful in the way that material is handled as well as the way it's disposed in.
We heard from Anna Gilmore Hall at the opening of the show today, the executive director of Healthcare Without Harm. Here she is talking about IV drips in hospitals.
There's a huge amount of products used in the healthcare sector that have PVC in them. Because many of the products that have PVC also need to be very flexible because of their interaction with the patient, like an IV bag or the IV tubing that goes from the IV bag to the patient. There's also a chemical that's put into PVC products called DEHP, which makes the PVC more flexible and easier to use. Oftentimes that chemical can leach out of the plastic, out of the PVC, into the solution, for instance, if it's an IV bag, and actually enter into the patient's bloodstream. And we know that that's a neurotoxin. We know that that causes severe problems with certain kinds of individuals, particularly babies. And that's one of the reasons why we work a lot with the neonatal intensive care units to try and get as much PVC out of NICUs as we possibly can.
Anna Gilmore Hall, the executive director of Healthcare Without Harm. What about that? What about materials used in IV bags and efforts to change these products?
You know, the healthcare industry definitely works towards minimizing those risks. Doctors in the healthcare industry has the Hippocratic Oath to first do no harm. And so ANOVA is working to eliminate and to reduce these PVC DHP products, especially in the NICU. We are working with the industry to find alternatives as well as to implement those alternatives because, indeed, the health of our patient is our number one priority.
Relatively speaking, what's an easy way to start making a difference?
It really comes down to what many people call the low-hanging fruit. But I would actually take a step further when it comes to the healthcare industry and say it comes down to looking at the fruit on the floor, because those are opportunities that are absolutely perfectly ripe and ready to capitalize on immediately. Those first opportunities really come towards looking at the waste streams.
What waste streams in particular? Tell us about some of the low-lying fruit or the floor fruit.
Sure. Well, I would definitely say one of the largest areas to look at is having a strong commingled recycling program. And while that may seem like a no-brainer for many industries, implementing something as simple as recycling in a healthcare setting is actually quite complex because of the multiple regulators related to all of the waste stream and the cradle-to-grave responsibility that the healthcare industry has, that hospitals have with their waste. But that being said, it is definitely one of the first and key areas to look at, and it is also one of the most visible ways to engage employees with the sustainability programs within a hospital.
When you start thinking about a few years ahead and some of the bigger challenges, some of the things you'd think, wow, I'd love to do something about that, but we can't get to that yet. Talk about some of those long-term goals, some of those bigger projects.
One of the challenges that we're currently being faced with is implementing some of the long-range energy efficiency goals. It is really balancing investing the capital and looking at where the capital needs to be spent first within the program. For instance, where we may have opportunities to replace some large equipment such as chillers and boilers, that requires a large sum of capital, and that can be challenging, but it is important to incorporate that in a long-term project.
Seema Wadhwa, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Seema Wadhwa is a consultant working as a sustainability engineer with the ANOVA Health System in Northern Virginia. At 19 minutes past the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
You're listening to Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5. Good afternoon. I'm Rebecca Shear, filling in for Bill Redlin. With the winter storm warning in effect until 10 p.m. tomorrow, a snow emergency is in effect on D.C.'s streets. Motorists should look for the red and white snow emergency route signs and put their cars somewhere else. Illegally parked vehicles are subject to a $250 fine plus towing and impound fees. The National Weather Service is predicting record snowfall for the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. region with extremely dangerous winter weather conditions developing tonight. It's 33 degrees in Northwest Washington. Metro Connection continues.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Oshkosh Corporation, a global business delivering vehicles and equipment for the world's defense, emergency, and commercial applications for more than 90 years. Oshkosh, beyond confidence. From the Walmart Foundation, committed to helping people live better through charitable giving in their community and everywhere that Walmart and Sam's Club serve.
This is Metro Connection. I'm David First. Coming up, personal stories from around the city, courtesy of Speakeasy DC. And a pug owner deals with some bedtime boundary issues. But before that, a recent commentary by Fred Fisk criticized talk show host Rush Limbaugh, and it generated many responses. Some listeners echoed Fred's comments, but many others took Fred to task. Commentator Brent Bozell is the founder and president of the Media Research Center, which is based in Alexandria.
Public radio listeners are told during pledge drives that stations like WAMU are a civil space for information. Since public radio isn't driven by ratings, they don't have to shout and be partisan and mean-spirited. That notion was shattered by Fred Fisk on January 21st when he denounced Rush Limbaugh. He actually suggested Limbaugh's radio show was defined by the phrase, quote, excrement in broadcasting, unquote. Now, Fisk wasn't shouting, but grade school dirty toilet insults don't exactly match the image of calm sophistication that public radio presents to its listeners. Fisk claimed he didn't despise Rush Limbaugh anymore, but nasty invective suggests that the hatred has never ended. Fisk denounced Rush as heartless and bigoted, as if he's ever spent an hour with this man to be able to pass such a personal judgment. All this came because, said Fisk, Rush had told his listeners that they should not donate their money to the victims of the earthquake in Haiti. That is simply untrue. Rush did boast that Americans are the most generous donors in the world, while anti-American countries like Cuba and Venezuela wouldn't match our help. That is true. Rush did suggest that despite decades of American aid, Haiti continues to be the economic wasteland of the Caribbean. That is unquestionable. Rush certainly insinuated that the Haiti crisis would be seen as a political opportunity inside the White House. Ask any conservative about how thoroughly liberals exploited the crisis of Hurricane Katrina, using it for political purposes, casting President Bush as a racist. Limbaugh's argument, again, is defensible. At no point did he ever call on Americans not to supply humanitarian aid, period. How many times must the left be exposed for flat-out inventing things Limbaugh has supposedly said, only later to learn he never said any such thing? I'm Brent Bozell.
And to let us know what you think, go to conversation.wamu.org and click on Commentary Forum. This month, PBS stations are airing a new documentary, For Love of Liberty, the story of America's Black Patriots. It tells the story of African-American servicemen and women in a film that spans the time from the Revolutionary War through the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Hosted by Halle Berry, the project is narrated by Avery Brooks, introduced by Colin Powell, and boasts narration from the likes of Morgan Freeman and Bill Cosby. Stephanie Kay caught up with filmmaker Frank Martin at a screening in D.C., where he described the construction of the film.
It's a collection of letters, diaries, speeches, magazine articles. There are no interviews in the film, per se. We wanted to make this documentary play like a feature. And the thought was that the only way you were ever going to really get to the first-person accounts was through letters and things like that, because obviously there's nobody who can talk about the Revolution or 1812 or the Civil War anymore.
I was born on the eastern shore of Maryland in the year of our Lord, 1753, in a state of slavery, and belonged to Francis de Shields. He was a colonel in Washington's army.
So we found all these wonderful letters that had been written, and we reached out to this, you know, this extraordinary collection of talent. I tried to first use these letters to tell personal stories. So it's not a big history lesson, but the letters are woven together so that it gives you the big picture as well. The Revolution is so far distant that, you know, when you think of the Revolution, you think of George Washington. And you think that, you know, everybody that fought in the Revolution was white. Well, the first person to lose their life in the cause that would ultimately become the Revolution was a black man, Crispus Attucks, you know. So, and there was the Rhode Island, first Rhode Island Regiment, was a black regiment that fought in the Battle of New York City. So, you know, it's a story that goes all the way back to the beginning of the nation. And you know, I like to tell people that this is a film that is relevant to all Americans because it graphically depicts the price of liberty.
I was with him through the whole course of the Revolutionary War. There, human blood ran down in torrents till the waters of the river were red as crimson. Revolutionary War veteran James Roberts.
The documentary asks a very important question, and the question it asks is, why would a group of people shed their blood in defense of a nation that treated them worse than second-class citizens? Why would they do that? You know, and that question is answered over and over in the course of the film. And, you know, and basically the answer to that question is, like all Americans in all wars, African Americans fought for love of liberty.
Why is it important to shed light on the black soldiers over this period of time? And why do you think they're always left out of the story?
Because it goes to the heart of who we are as a people. Our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, out of many, one. It's a wonderful slogan, but it wasn't true, especially if you were black. And that's a situation that changed only recently.
Their words are relevant to every American and speak of courage, honor, duty, and sacrifice for love of liberty. I'm Halle Berry, and this is their story.
People ask me, why is this story relevant today? And, you know, the answer to that question is, you look at a movie like Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers, wonderful film about Iwo Jima, and Clint is certainly not a racist, nor is he a stupid man, and, you know, he's a wonderful filmmaker. But there are no black people in that movie, you know, and you think, well, why is that? In part, I have to say, I think the answer to that question is Hollywood history informs a lot of our public opinion. Hollywood has vastly underserved the black soldier. Nobody made movies about him. They didn't teach it in schools. So people are just unaware of it. We've all heard of the Buffalo Soldiers. We've heard about the Tuskegee Airmen. Maybe we saw Glory. But that's pretty much all anybody really knows about this story. And that's why it's important for people to see the film. There were black men and women fighting in every conflict that this country has been engaged in since before the revolution.
It sounds like you want to bring something to light, but also maybe change people's thinking and the way they perceive their fellow Americans, their sacrifices. What power does film have to make that happen?
Well, I think film has the power to set the record straight. I'm 54. I was in the Navy in the early 70s, so my war was Vietnam. Every generation has their war. And, you know, people at the end of Vietnam, the soldiers came home and they were ignored. Everybody talks about that to this day, and it was a terrible tragedy. But that's what happened to black soldiers in every single war that they ever fought. In the Revolution, many of them were sent back to slavery. In 1812, the same thing. So the goal of this film is to shed light on, you know, on these stories. And again, the film is not a historical analysis of this subject. It's a collection of stories about individuals. So as you go through the film, you come to know people like Christian Fleetwood, who was a Medal of Honor recipient from the Civil War. You come to know a man named James Roberts, who served in both the Revolution and 1812, and who was the author of one of the first slave narratives. And it's through their stories that you really come to appreciate the price of liberty.
Filmmaker Frank Martin speaking with Stephanie Kay. The documentary is called For Love of Liberty, the story of America's black patriots. For more information and a link to an air schedule for the program, you can visit metroconnection.org. We launch a new series now, a collection of personal stories from all over the district, produced by the storytelling performance group Speakeasy DC. It's called Our City, Our Stories. In part one, we meet a woman in Northeast Washington living in Ward 5. Carolyn Parham faced a life-changing challenge when she received an unexpected check in the mail. For more, David Schultz meets Carolyn where she works, the local nonprofit DC Central Kitchen. Here's David.
Back in 2001, her house flooded. A few days later, a guy showed up from FEMA at her house. You know, and the guy was looking around. He said, you know, this place is unlivable. You can't live here. And they said, we'll be, you know, contacting you. She was like, yeah. I'm sure they'll be contacting me really soon, you know. So, you know, a few days after that, she was just walking home from school.
So when I opened up the mailbox, there was a check. It had the Statue of Liberty on it. And the check was for $5,000 made out to me. I never sat on the front of, at that building because there's always some drug dealers out there. And I just sat there in shock. And I sat there on the front. And my kids was like, Mommy, you okay? And I was so nervous.
What made her nervous was that she'd never seen this much money before in her entire life. I mean, Carolyn is a recovering drug addict. And usually when she has money, she would use it on drugs. And she tried to get clean a bunch of times, but she'd always relapsed. And now here she was at her apartment, drug dealers a few hundred yards away, and she had a $5,000 check with her name on it.
So I went inside. And I called a lady that was working here at the time, Karen. I called her and I said, Karen, I need your help. I just got a $5,000 check in the mail. And she said, okay, well, put the check away. And she said it like real stern, like no ifs, ands. She was like, and bring it with you tomorrow morning to the meeting, an NA meeting I went to every Saturday morning with my kids. Goodbye. I was like, how can she just leave me with all this money? She know I ain't got but 5 months clean. And I wanted Karen to come and take the check from me. I went through everything that they said that you go through before you get ready to relapse. Every bad thing that I did, you know, getting high was in my head. During my addiction, I have copped drugs with my children, you know, because I went out in the middle of the night with my infant and laid her in the bushes and went over across the street to get high in a crack house because she was asleep in the bushes. Nothing would have been new for me. I was crying. I was looking at my kids. I probably watched them all night and actually asking myself, you know, are they worth it? You know, if I go get high, I'm not going to come back. I fought with myself all night. That's what I did. I fought with my own self all night.
Okay, so it's Saturday morning, and she just spent the longest night of her life staring at her kids and staring at this check and wondering what to do. So she goes down to the NA meeting that she goes to every Saturday with her kids. And her friend Karen, the one that she called the night before, the friend who had hung up on her, she was running the meeting.
And when I went in there, I'm like, here. I was just so glad to get the check out of my hand. And she was like, okay, hold it. And she gave it back to me. So I sat in that meeting sweating. And she was like, Carolyn, you need to share. So, you know, I started talking about how I was feeling. And after talking about it, I felt a little better because I was in a safe place. But I still was, you know, I still was nervous.
Right after the meeting, Carolyn goes to the bank, opens an account, and deposits to the check.
Karen kept telling me, she said, you got bills to pay, you got girls to take care of, you want a better life. She brought up everything that I used to share about in the early morning meetings. Carolyn, you got to realize that you are the sole provider for these girls. So when she dropped us off at the apartment, you know, I go back in to check the damn mailbox. And there was another $5,000 check in the mailbox. Somebody is really testing me. I didn't look at it at that time as a blessing. I'm like, somebody is really testing my recovery. But that check didn't make me nervous. I think I had prepared myself. I had went through enough and I was burnt out. You know, I was burnt out. I took the check. I said, come on, y'all, we're going to do something. We went to the liquor store, cashed the check, and I took my children. I bought them a few things, you know, because they hadn't had anything new in at least a year. I didn't buy myself nothing, but I got them some cute little tennis shoes that light up when they walk and got them a few little outfits. We went out to eat, and then we caught a cab home. We didn't have to catch the bus, you know. It made me feel like I don't have to get high no more because I said to myself, I'm never going to have that amount of money in my hand again, ever. I'm not, you know. I've just made it through $10,000 and I did not smoke no crack. So it was like nothing in this world could make me get high again. It's nothing. I was happy as hell. I'm telling you that I had made it through them two $5,000 checks.
David Schultz produced this story with series editor Shay Shackelford. Our City, Our Stories is a project of Speakeasy DC and was made possible with funding from the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. We're joined by Amy Sedman, the director of Speakeasy DC. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Speakeasy DC produces storytelling performances. How did you decide to launch this Our City, Our Stories project?
It actually came out of the motivation that what we do best is put people on stage, help them take their personal stories and turn them into something that they can perform in front of an audience, or at least tell in front of an audience. But that kind of limits the pool of people that we get to hear their stories. So only those people that can come to the show are willing to actually put the work in advance and stand up on a stage. So we thought, well, why don't we expand our reach by actually going out and collecting stories, putting them on tape, helping people shape them through the process of editing. So that was the motivation.
What were the stories that you wanted to tell?
We really kind of had a broad stroke. I mean, we do, all of the things that we do are usually theme-based. So we'll create a theme around which all the stories fit. So this time we created a theme that was stepping up and stepping out, stories about overcoming obstacles and getting things done. But that's a pretty broad theme. And the idea being that we just wanted to hit different parts of the city. So we got stories from four different wards and different angles on that theme. And the idea being that it's also people's true personal stories.
Carolyn, who we heard from today, strikes me as an example of somebody who might have been anxious about telling her story in front of a room full of people. So this was an opportunity to connect with somebody who might not come to a Speakeasy DC event.
Exactly. She's a great example of that. And yet she was very eager to tell her story. It's a story she feels really good about and that she thinks will inspire other people. But yeah, actually her rehearsing it and getting up on a stage probably would have been unlikely.
Tell us more about Speakeasy DC. I know you have a special Valentine's Day show coming up.
We do. So we produce about 20 shows a year, and they're all around, like I said, people telling, using their personal experiences and stories, nonfiction, autobiographical stories that are put on stage. Once a month, we have an open mic. So anybody can sign up, and we offer free coaching so to get your story ready for the stage. But we also have special shows like we have Sucker for Love is our Valentine special. We did it last year. We're doing it again this year at Chief Ike's for three nights. We have another show that's part of Intersections Arts Festival at the Atlas Performing Arts Center, and that is called Wetbacks, Aliens, and Towelheads, Stories from the First Generation. There's three children of immigrants and two people that are immigrants themselves, and they're telling the stories from that perspective.
And when are those Valentine's shows happening?
February 12th. 13th and 14th.
Okay, for more information on all of these events and on Speakeasy DC in general, just go to our website, metroconnection.org. Amy Sedman, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Amy Sedman is the director of Speakeasy DC. Speaking of storytelling, reporter Kathy Duchamp has one to tell now about boundaries, pets in the bed, and serious snoring.
It's 4:41 in the morning, and I really didn't want to be awake this early. But there's something that woke me up. Something that wakes me up a lot. And that's Willa. She's a pug. She's 14 years old. And I love her, but she's driving me crazy.
It's very disturbing. Not conducive to sleep.
That's Gene, the guy I share my bed with, along with Willa.
It keeps you awake. It keeps me awake. We're constantly restless, trying to shift her, move her, to get her to stop snoring during the night. wearing earplugs and other things doesn't even help anymore.
Some of you listening to this is going to be, you idiots, just kick her butt out of the bed and put her in her crate.
Yes. Sadly, she howls and whines and screams through the night because she suffers from major separation anxiety.
We have another whiny dog, Lucy, a 12-year-old toy terrier. At least she doesn't snore. So how did it come to this? The backstory is that I've known the dogs much longer than Jean. I got them when I was married, a union that ended not coincidentally because of boundary issues. For me and my ex, the dogs were living stuffed animals. They brought back the comfort of childhood.
Stuffed animals don't leave skid marks on the pillow or the sheets. They don't snore. They don't hork up loogies.
A few months ago, I came across a show on cable TV called It's Me or the Dog. I wonder what the producers would suggest for Willa the snoring pug. I feel like we've tried everything. And as Willa gets older, the snoring gets louder.
And then there was that pill you found called Snore Stop.
Mm-hmm. Which seemed to occasionally work. And then there's antihistamines, Benadryl.
When pharmaceuticals failed, we turned to a $50 contraption called the Kong Dispenser. It released red plastic toys loaded with peanut butter into Willa's crate every 4 hours.
She just freaked out until the next Kong came and gave her more food. So she just whined for hours.
This whole thing has strained our relationship. But the real breaking point wasn't the snoring. It was figuring out what to do with the dogs when we went on vacation. I'd always hired a dog sitter to sleep with Willa and Lucy. Jean thought that was ridiculous. So I turned to my friend, Cece Bauer.
Put them in a kennel like everybody else does.
And I resisted.
Yes, because you thought their feelings were going to be hurt.
Right, and it's loud and noisy and stressful, and they'd have to sleep on a concrete floor with dog poop all around them.
Well, I think they keep the kennels clean, but they are dogs.
What do you mean?
I mean, dogs are okay with sleeping in a kennel with loud barking noises and cement floors.
How do you know that?
Because they're dogs.
I checked out a few kennels and finally chose one. Things have worked out fine. I guess I'm starting to understand what Cece is adamant about, that there are boundaries for everyone. Without them?
Oh, life would be chaos. I mean, we have rules with the kids, rules with the dogs. I even have a cat. The cat can't climb up on stuff either. In our house, at least, we have to have some semblance of order, or we would not get through our days.
So, yeah, there's chaos in our house. But what can we do? The dogs are old. Imagine switching up the routine of your 98-year-old grandmother. The dogs won't be around that much longer. And so, we just suffer.
Our story was produced by Kathy Duchamp. No pets were harmed during the making of this feature, but two humans did lose a lot of sleep.
I'm so tired, I haven't slept a wink. I'm so tired, my mind is on the blink. I wonder, should I get up?
Coming up, arts critic Colleen Fay is back to tell us about a must-see exhibit at the National Gallery of Art. At 15 minutes before the hour, this is Metro Connection on WAMU 88.5.
Good afternoon. I'm Rebecca Shearer filling in for Bill Redlin. The National Weather Service is predicting record snowfall in the Baltimore, Washington, D.C. region, 20 to 30 inches, with extremely dangerous winter weather conditions developing this evening. Strong winds and heavy wet snow will produce near blizzard conditions through tomorrow morning, so the Weather Service is asking people, please, to stay off the roads tonight. In the district, please note D.C. Public Schools has canceled all Friday and weekend after-school programs, including Saturday Scholars, athletic games, and extracurricular activities sponsored by D.C. Public Schools. Metro Connection continues.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from the Sanju K. Bansal Foundation, dedicated to helping people help themselves through improved access to information. from Trader Joe's, a neighborhood grocery store offering prepared dinner choices, including marinated meats, heat and eat sides, and stir fries, all with flavors from around the globe. Locations at TraderJoe's.com.
Every few weeks, Metro Connection Arts editor Colleen Fay joins us with her Best Bets, where she highlights some of the must-see events going on around town. This time, the focus is on one visual arts exhibition at the National Gallery of Art. Colleen Fay, welcome back.
Great to be here.
So tell us about this exhibit, the Chester Dale Collection. This just opened on January 31st.
Well, you know, it's funny. We as press people get announcements of upcoming events, gallery openings, new shows coming to a theater, and so on. And we sort of mentally put them in categories, things I've got to take a look at, things I'd like to take a look at, and things it'd be good to if I had the time. And so I saw the announcement for the Chester Dale Collection, and I thought, oh, well, gee, this would be very nice, and I should put it in the I probably ought to go to see it pile. So I went there to this opening a week or so ago, and I was absolutely blown away. Here's the reason why. These are some of the best, most well-known paintings in the National Gallery of Art collection, and yet here they are all gathered together to highlight the collecting activity of their donor. Once you see them together, you realize one person, or actually it was two people, Mr. Dale and his wife Maud, who brought this collection together in the 20s and 30s and into the 40s and 50s a little bit. And the interesting thing about it is that you realize that these folks knew this stuff to be masterpieces, and they were collecting it and spending boatloads of money on it, to be sure. At the time, Mr. Dale was a Wall Street investment banker, and he used his money wisely. We see them together, and you just are blown away. One masterpiece after another. It's as if, as the first time I saw it, I really couldn't get my mind around all these amazing pictures because I just couldn't take them all in at a single viewing. I had to go back a couple more times and realize some of these things I've been seeing, oh, all the years I've been in Washington, which is a lot of years, and other things seem to me brand new. But the fact that one couple put this amazing collection together just blew me away.
Now, the full name of the show, it's called From Impressionism to Modernism, the Chester Dale Collection. And what blows you away here is not just the fact that, wow, this is some great artwork, but that this was one collection.
Yeah, and the fact is that they knew what they were collecting when they were collecting it. At the same time, they were collecting, let's say, the Impressionist masterpieces that people even in the 20s and 30s had recognized as masterpieces. The Dales were also collecting works by contemporary artists who hadn't yet had the stamp of masterpiece placed on them. Artists like Matisse and Picasso and Georges Braque, they were collecting art from these artists when the oil wasn't even dry on the canvas. They weren't just looking for the solid gold things from the past, but they were looking for what would turn out to be the solid gold of their present.
So they had a very strong sense of what made great art.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's so interesting because there weren't art schools, and you didn't have a degree in art history as if you can get from many universities today. People trained their eyes to look at art. They talked to experts, but they made up their own minds, and they learned to create a collection where things would go together. Now, the other thing I want to mention about this exhibit, which I think is a lot of what makes it so great, is that curators of the exhibit have taken a tremendous effort to put different paintings from different eras, different artists, together. And you see connections between paintings that you weren't able to see when these were hanging in a different gallery upstairs in the National Gallery of Art, because sometimes they were, you know, 10 galleries apart, and here they are side by side.
These are works that we've been able to see at the National Gallery of Art over the years, but not together in this way. Could you tell us about some of the better-known paintings in the collection?
Well, there are two amazing large pictures. One is Manet's The Old Musician, which shows a group of people standing around an elderly man who's seated playing the violin. And this picture, which is about 6 feet by 9 feet, it's huge. One of the greatest masterpieces painted by a master painter that exists in any museum anywhere. On the opposite wall is a Picasso painting, which is sort of an emblem of Picasso. It's called The Family of the Saltimbiques, and it comes from the early part of the 20th century, 1905. It's also gathering a family. They don't look particularly happy, but the way in which the characters on this another huge canvas relate to one another is eerily familiar to us because we've just seen it in the Manet. And you look at the Picasso and you're studying that, and then you go back to the Manet and you realize these are amazing masterpieces by two painters coming at a subject matter, you know, a group of people who relate to one another in some way. It's like two different approaches going for the same sort of thing. And you look and you say, this is amazing stuff. And I've never seen these pictures this close together ever. And because of this exhibit, I get to see them in a completely different way.
The show is called From Impressionism to Modernism, the Chester Dale Collection. This is going on through July 31st of 2011 at the National Gallery of Art. Colleen Fay, good to see you again.
It's always a pleasure.
Colleen Fay is Metro Connections Arts Editor. And finally today, there's no one Washington sound or single Washington music scene, but there are some musical styles that are rarely made here. One of them is the mostly European genre dubbed post-rock, which uses the rock band format but draws on jazz, classical, and other styles. Critic Mark Jenkins says Radiohead is a notable example, but says there's one closer at hand, Belfleur, whose sound is way outside the Beltway.
That spacey passage is the intro to Bright Lights from Belfleur's Last Quarter of the 20th Century Blues. There's no blues on this five-song EP, which mostly sounds more contemporary than the last quarter of the last century. The Suburban Maryland Quartet does draw on some 1970s innovations, including German cosmic rock and Brian Eno's ambient music. But tracks like Gray Sparkle Finnish Pig assemble the band's influences in an up-to-date way. Four members of Belfleur are credited with samples, and the band's music sometimes has the chilly sheen of purely synthetic music. But there's plenty of live percussion to offset the electronic clicks, drones, and washes. And while Belfleur is capable of pounding a 4-4 beat, tracks like Shooting an Elephant add percussive layers that suggest Africa's polyrhythms and Indonesia's interlocking melodies. Unlike some post-rockers, Belfleur doesn't discount the human voice. Guitarist-keyboardist Carlos Gonzalez-Fernandez, bassist-keyboardist Tom Longobardi, and drummer Hunter Sopp all sing. This EP also adds the violins and vocals of Susan and Emily Hsu, the sisters who front another local group, Exit Clove. That adds yet another texture to the title song, Last Quarter of the 20th Century Blues. Belle Fleur has been together for almost a decade, working both to define its sound and to keep it fresh. In addition to inviting guests into the studio, the quartet has added string and horn players on stage. More important than the band's stylistic diversity, however, is its unity. Tracks like The Rhythms of Waking and Sleeping roam a lot of musical territory, but they never lose their way.
When you stop and catch your breath, when the words escape your lips, you try to
Belle Fleur's new EP is called Last Quarter of the 20th Century Blues. Mark Jenkins reviews music for Blurt, Spin Magazine, and The Washington Post, and reviews film for NPR.org and RealDC.com. And for this week, that's Metro Connection. We had extra production help from Jonathan Chary, Andrew Chadwick, Rebecca Berlin, Margot Kelly, and Bill Redlin. The show's theme song, Zero Wave, was written and performed by the D.C. area band Astrolite. You can hear Metro Connection on the web if you missed a news segment or if you'd like to download a podcast. Just go to our webpage, metroconnection.org. As always, we'd like to thank our tireless web team for keeping the page up to date every week. We'd like to hear what you have to say about the show. The Metro Connection listener comment line is 202-885-8854. Once again, that's 202-885-8854. And if you'd like to send email, that address is metro...